The following pod contains spoilers. Listener discretion is advised.
As an imported Asian adoptee or hyphenated Asian, are you looking for stories and people that you can relate to? If yes, then check out The Universal Asian. The Universal Asian is an open platform run in the magazine style with written articles, poetry, prose, photos, art, and videos on a variety of topics. No topic is off limits. They host online events that showcase what members of our Universal Asian community are doing or provide support through how-tos or discussions on topics of interest. Visit and subscribe at theuniversalasian.com or follow them on your preferred social media platform. Join the Universal Asian community today.
Hey there, listeners. This is Baldwin here. I want to talk to you about this new app called Shuffle, which allows you to engage with your favorite podcasts. So this means that on the app, you actually get to edit audio clips, add visual elements, react, and share on your socials. I think it's really cool because people can ask us questions on this AI chatbot where me and my fellow co-hosts may or may not be the one answering. Is it us or not? Who knows? Download the app and try it to find out. We have a new community chat for you fans out there that love AAPI cinema. You can chat with other fans, ask us questions, get film recommendations, and more. Right now, we have a special offer just for you. Shuffle is going to sponsor 10 of our fans for their first month when they download the app and sign up for our Patreon. All you have to do is download the Shuffle app, join the Real Asian Podcast community chat, sign up for our Patreon, and we'll select 10 people to sponsor their first month. To join the community today, go to realasianpodcast.com/shuffle.
Hey guys, this is Renee filling in for Ray. Welcome to this episode of Real Asian Podcast. I'm joined here with my co-hosts Baldwin.
Hey guys.
And Pragya.
Hi, everybody.
So we're here today to talk about this amazing best of film for 2019 by Bong Joon-ho called Parasite. Maybe you have or have not heard of it. Jumping right into it, it was something as categorized as a black comedy thriller film. I know here that Pragya actually thinks that it's more horror than thriller. We actually had a little debate about that, and I was like, all right, I'll let you keep on having holding on to that horror genre. But yeah, it was co-written by Han Jin-woon, who is actually returning for his third screenplay with Bong, normally credited as the assistant. You know, it was really great to be able to see this kind of film kind of come into play after being worked on for almost over 7 years. Parasite won 4 awards from the 92nd Academy Awards show, which included Best Picture, Best Director, Best Original Screenplay, and Best International Film Feature. And so I'd love to talk a little bit about this later on. So the film features two main families, and actually, if you've watched it, it also includes a emerging third family in the back half of the film. The two families really showed a huge disparity between wealth. You have the Parks, who are the rich family with this gigantic house, whose bathroom is basically bigger than the entirety of my in-law that I lived in San Francisco for 4 years. And the Kims, the family that lives in a semi-basement unit that happens upon an opportunity to con their way into the Parks house. I'd love to go ahead and turn it over to my co-hosts here to get their quick take.
So the first time I watched this movie was actually on a plane. It was before the pandemic, and my partner and I were traveling to Asia, and we had some time to kill, so we thought...
Oh, yeah, there you go. I was going to say, this is a really long flight. It can't be, like, just to, like, New York or something.
Yeah, it was, like, Southeast Asia, so we had, like, 15 hours to kill.
Oh, wow.
And
yeah.
we were like, hey, why not, you know, see what everybody's talking about? And, man, this is... What a movie to, like, watch on the plane. I remember, like, oh, damn, that was, like, a mind fuck. Like, did that really just happen? Just like considering the reaction we had from watching it on a 5x7 screen, I have to give major kudos to Bong Joon-ho for just like creating an expertly crafted film. The movie itself was just really fun to watch, and how seeing how these poor people were just really good at scheming and swindling this rich family. But then there's that huge pivot in the middle of it that you just don't expect at all. And you're like, oh shit, what's going to happen now? But I mean, it was really masterful in how well thought everything was. And watching it for a second time, like, you can appreciate all the details and all the foreshadowing that happens throughout the film. But I mean, there's just so many layers to the movie. And we'll get into that. And there's so much subtext into the smallest things. And Junho basically uses every tool he can to reinforce his overall message, you know, and that goes from the use of lighting and their physical positions to the hair and makeup and costumes. And especially the dialogue in the movie, you know, I was really impressed at how all of these elements came together to make a really elegant film, I would say. And it just, it's like feels really high class in the way it's done with all the classical music and the strings and just the story itself. It sort of feels Shakespearean in a sense.
I love how you equate classical music to like high class.
Yeah.
It's hilarious.
Throw some classical music in there.
I think Junho will love that. I actually watched the film quite late. Everybody had been talking about it and I wasn't really as interested because, like I said, I don't like horror films. my parents actually watched it before I even got a choice to, and they were like, no, you have to watch it. Wow. And eventually I got so much pressure that during the quarantine, my friend and I were doing like all sorts of Asian films, and we watched a few Bong Joon-ho films. We watched like, what's it called? The Host first. So when it came time for The Parasite, which like the films kind of have like an interplay there with their titles, right? I think I pretty much knew what I was getting myself into. And I think that I can see why it's been such a mainstream success. But when I like watch it and then I hear sort of the topical reporting on it and the conversation, I'm just like, oh, I want to sit all of you people down and just like, we need to have a real conversation about this. So I'm glad we're getting to do that with the podcast.
Right. No, absolutely. I've been a really big fan of Bong Joon-ho for a really long time. I saw The Host actually when it came out in a Asian film festival so many like years ago, like 2013, I think it was, or even, no, it was earlier than like 2007 or something. And so that was really amazing to be able to experience that movie. And he was relatively unheard of in the U.S. I definitely want to say that, like, I've been following his films ever since. And, you know, one of the other ones back in 2017 that he released was Okja with Steven Yeun, who we all love here at RAP. I don't know why, but I was holding out on watching Parasite for so long. And I think it was because like, oh, well, I liked him before everyone else did, kind of hipster vibe going on with me. So, you know, my bad.
Too cool.
I did watch the movie just recently, actually. So, you know, but that's not to say that I completely ignored it. I did read a lot of commentary about it. So, you know, while bobbing and weaving those spoilers. So I would definitely say, like, this is also another masterful piece by Bong Joon-ho. And it was just absolutely riveting. You know, I did feel like maybe there were one or two portions of the film that were a little bit on the slower end. But that's actually his MO, is to actually play things out and like taffy, just pull it and just extract as much out of each little scene, each other detail. And so, you know, if you're someone who likes to chew up the scenery, like, then, you know, Parasite definitely is a movie that you should watch. So jumping right in then to our segments, what were some of your guys' favorite scenes?
So there's the scene where after they have their dinner and the park sort of crashed their party and they have to rush back home in the rain, and we just see them sort of descending lower and lower into the levels of society, kind of. I felt that was really artfully well done. It sort of reminded me of Wes Anderson movies. I don't know if you've seen them, like Grand Budapest Hotel. But it's the first time we see them take that full trek, and so much is communicated visually through that scene. Like they have to go through this chaotic rain and flooding that completely destroys their home. And you also see the light just gets dimmer and dimmer until they reach their alley home. Like they're going from the really well lit areas of the Park household. They're going down to the sewers under the bridges, in the tunnels, and then all the way down to the alleyway where there's just like a few streetlights there. But you can completely see the difference between their two families by showing this journey. And then it ends up in the Kims waking up in a crowded gym shelter, and then contrast that with Mrs. Park waking up to like a vanity mirror, getting like glowed up, picking out her outfits, you know? So that part was really strong to me.
I love that. I love the way that you juxtapose those two scenes and just your description of it, because it definitely felt like the Kims were descending into like purgatory almost, yeah. Right? It had this feeling of just like despair. So I really liked the way that you kind of, yeah, because when, when Mrs. Park woke up, she was like, oh, the blinding light of the sun. And, you know, it was like as if it was like a fairy tale for her.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't know that I have a lot of sympathy for the Kim family, so I think my favorite scene is probably when the third family, the husband and wife pair, they are in the basement, and the Kims are like threatening them with like, oh, like we'll tell on you guys that you're down here or whatever. And then all of a sudden, like the whole family like falls down, and they're like, they find out their scam, and all of a sudden the tables turn. And like, that moment was just so like, it relieved a lot of the tension, right? But then it also gets you like some like real frank conversation going about like what exactly is going on here. Mm-hmm. So, cause at first the mother is like, oh, what the heck are you doing down here? You like, you know, you shameful people or whatever. And they're like, oh, okay. You want to talk about us right now? Let's talk about you. So that's my favorite scene.
Everything sort of just like came to light in that scene, right?
Yeah.
In that same vein, you know, that part where the housekeeper records the family on video and sort of uses them to hold them hostage.
Yeah, the hostage scene.
She's just like basically like so close to blowing up their whole life. Mm-hmm. And like so much rides on that. On just a little pressure from that thumb to hit that send button. So it sort of like makes you realize.
She should have done it. She should have just done it. She had too much kindness in her. If it was them, they would have done it.
Yeah. It like sort of shows how hitting the send button has gotten so powerful. Like when you think of social media, how many lives have been ruined by a tweet or inadvertent snap, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I like the way that you said blow up their life, because they really did call it like a nuclear button, right?
I guess for me, my
favorite scene kind of revolved around like just the disillusionment that the family has which family I'm talking about, specifically about the Kims, right? Like, are you supposed to like them and feel for them? Like, and it's maybe a rhetorical question, but not really. I mean, like, Pragya is like, I don't like them.
I mean, I think that's basically a you issue, right? Like, where you fall into, like, the families just kind of tells you about how you view class struggle.
Mm.
And so if you are feeling that the Kim family is sympathetic, and you can still feel that way after the sort of big reveal and what goes down immediately after the reveal. So you've got like, you know, the murder attempts and all of that. It just like asks you to think about how you consider class relations.
Right.
If you're going to have anarchy, you're always going to have people who are bad actors, right? So it almost creates that dilemma for you within the film.
So jumping off of that, like there's this one scene with a particular quote where the Kims are actually talking amongst themselves. The Parks have gone off on a camping trip. And so they basically invade their home like rats almost, and just like
infest,
eat everything
like
in excess. Exactly. Nice. I'm pointing at Baldwin. Like, they've completely just living in excess, right? They're getting full of just eating whatever they want. They're, you know, taking baths. I mean, that sounds terrible saying that, but And they're drinking their ass off, right? Like just completely, you know, just in excess. And so, but they're talking amongst themselves and, you know, so Kitek says, she's rich, but still nice. Like they talk about the nativity of the rich people. But then the wife comes in, Chung Suk says, not rich, but still nice. She's nice because she's rich. Mm-hmm. Hell, if I had all this money, I'd be nice too, right? And they talk about that the money, irons out all the creases of life, right? And so I really, that scene and the way that they described their own disillusionment of what like wealth does for them and things like that. Like, I was like, wow, like this really like was, that was actually the turning point of the movie. And I think that's why I really liked it, because that actually set up the rest of the movie to show, like, you know, like, rich people and their naivety, as they will, like, they're, you know, like they're still human, but also the poor are still human. And like, so it's like, who do you align with? And so I actually wanted to go in and talk a little bit more about the themes of the title of the film. What is Parasite? What does it mean? And I'd like to go ahead and turn it over to you, Baldwin. Maybe you can tell us a little bit more about what it means.
Wait. Before we do the what it means, can I just point out that the nice comment, that she's nice but rich, and then I'd be nice if I was rich, is a delusion, because the third family is nice, right? So just let's make sure to remember that. But okay, go ahead.
That's basically why I said I really liked it, because they are having this conversation. And then the third family comes in, right? Like right at that moment.
Right at
like,
that moment.
Who are you expecting, right?
Yeah.
But yeah, let's thanks for that nice little pause button.
Yeah.
About it. Yes. And let's explore the meaning of what Parasite, the name, why Bong Joon-ho chose Parasite as the name of it.
So I think the very obvious, connotation behind, Parasite within the movie is that the Kim family is basically lying to the Parks so that they can infiltrate their household and live off their wealth. So they could basically bring their cash flow into their household. You know, they're exploiting the rich by lying and stealing. But I think the interesting thing is that the Park family is exploiting the Kim family as well, and sort of like the lower class. You know, the difference is the Parks are living in comfort and luxury. They don't have somebody pissing outside their window. And it sort of like skews their perspective on things. Like they ask their servants for very basic, needs like cleaning, washing the dishes, cooking, driving them around. And then Mr. Park even says that his wife doesn't do well with the basic household stuff, you know, like with the cleaning and washing. So like by hiring others to do it, they're sort of leeching off the poor, because from their perspective, the poor should be overjoyed to even have the opportunity to clean their underwear or to make the ramen. So in a sense, I feel like pretty much all the main characters in this movie are parasites, but for just very different reasons.
Okay. So there's like a few levels of the parasite metaphor. So one is like that interaction level, right? And then we talk about how the Kim family infiltrates the Park family and so-called leeches off their resources. The implicit sort of like thing is that the Park family's riches come from exploiting the resources of the country and resources that are just available to the whole pool. So they're essentially like a tick who has gathered a lot of the blood, or the blood of the country. And like in terms of context, this is important, because in South Korea, you have like the chaebol system, which is just like these big families that practice like nepotism and like get into these gigantic corporate setups.
Right.
And like, you know, I'm sure you guys have seen like the YouTube thing about like, oh, where's the Samsung vice chairman or
there
whatever.
You go. And they I was just about to bring them up.
Right. And nobody wants to admit that he may be dead because of the wealth transfer that would occur when they have to pay inheritance taxes and stuff like that. And considering how much wealth that is, and how that is like a major Korean social issue, that like the fact that the wealth is like so, the disparity is so big, that like rich people sort of naturally come with this connotation of parasite, because like here are people living in squalor, 50% of the country's old people live in poverty.
Yep.
And then here are the Parks who are just like chilling, like villains, you know?
You make an excellent point, Pragya. And I think that's something that if you've watched Junho's films, that's a theme that he carries throughout everything, just abject poverty.
Right.
I don't know if you guys have had a chance to watch Snowpiercer.
Yeah,
but that's also one of the idea behind like the 1,000-car eternal engine. Like I really loved that film because of like there's miasma of cynicism to society, there is also this silver lining of hope. And so I would definitely say that that's something of Junho that he does quite often, is like talk about like the seedy underbelly of society and how he brings it to light in a way that is not only just a social commentary of like real life, but also tries to, you know, make it entertainment. So, you know, I also ask and think about it from this perspective, you know, like, isn't Junho part of the like social elite as well? Like, you know,
wait,
like,
so I was just about to say something crazy about this. I don't know if I told you, but the initial scene where Park Seo Joon gets Kevin's character into the family is a real life experience that Bong Joon-ho has.
Exactly.
Where his girlfriend was like working as a tutor or something at the time for a rich family and just like talked him up and got him a job there. And so then they had to pretend like they didn't know each other. and so like they're literally living the Kims at a time. And now he would be considered social elite because he's got so much success.
Right.
But, you know, that's a different conversation. I just wanted to throw that in there.
Right, exactly. Yeah. I mean, yeah, knowing that little tidbit that he actually drew a lot of the experiences of the film from, like, some of his own, some of his friends, right? They come from a time where Junho wasn't as well-known and was kind of, like, a struggling kind of student and things like that. I thought that was very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
I want to go ahead and unpack some central themes to the film. Two main ones that I want to talk about. I want to go into wealth, right? And, you know, it's really hard to miss that. It's everything about this film. And you kind of actually start off with this rock, actually, that opens up, that opens up the scene,
Scholar's Rock.
The Scholar's Rock. And how it promises wealth to the person that's being gifted to. I was watching an interview with Junho and the main character who plays Kevin, Choi Woo-si. Basically, what they were talking about is that how older generation people actually do gift the Scholar's Rock, but the newer generation actually don't really care about it. It was common for the older generation to actually share, you know, gift this to other families. So, even Junho admits that, like, this is kind of just a work of fiction, but it was something that was so pivotal, right? You see this actually transformed and used. Basically, you know, the way I felt was that Kevin, or Karen, no, it's not Kevin, but Kiwoo, basically.
Kiwoo, yeah.
His character is seen as kind of like clinging on to this wealth. That even at the very end, right? The ending is like he promises that we will be reunited when I make a lot of money, but it's a daydream.
I mean, first of all, I just want to say that when they get the Scholar's Rock, the whole family's reaction is like, you couldn't bring some food or something. I think that the Scholar's Rock in itself is already sort of existing in a realm where people have a certain amount of money, right? That sentimentality.
Right.
And Kiwoo / Kevin, as you said, maintains that sentimentality through the end. And even within the family, like, there are different types of disillusionment. Like, Jessica is sort of the chaos, darkness that...
Oh my god. If you're looking at an alignment chart,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, she is chaotic,
like chaotic evil.
She is chaotic evil, yeah. And I mean, I think that would be like a fun thing to do real quick, because I think Kevin is more like lawful evil, like, or like almost a chaotic neutral, but he gets like jammed along too easily, or like dragged along too easily
by the family.
Yeah, but regardless, to your question about wealth really quickly, So I think it's important to have context about South Korea when you're watching this film. And I mean, I may get some things wrong because obviously it's really difficult to like find like the true real information, stuff that goes down. But one of the things is that Bong Joon-ho is of a certain age, so he's seen certain types of revolutions in Korean history, right? Mm. Like students being killed, governments being like just like replaced. I think it goes from being authoritarian to like somewhat more democratic. But then like, you know, we all saw in the 2000s and the 2010s that they replaced their president. The whole country is like striking and protesting.
Oh my God. I mean, talking about the replacing the government, their president. I mean, the president was actually getting, was getting advised by like a cult leader. Like
yeah.
That, right.
So and the crazy. Cult thing just shows up so frequently as well.
Yeah.
I'm surprised it like didn't make a whole appearance in the film, but
that one's coming up. I'm sure
it's coming up. But so I think what you've seen is like people who like post World War II are moving from like extreme poverty to the point that one of the ways that they greet each other is like, have you eaten? Like, not how are you doing? It's have you eaten? So like there's like this extreme poverty, and I'm sure there's resentment that comes with that. And then you're moving into like this like hyper developed nation that comes with the wealth disparity. And the three families sort of show you an interesting breakdown of what that looks like. So you have the Park family, who is like rich, like clearly working for some kind of tech producer, right? The husband, and like they have everything that they want. Then you have the Kim family. And for the Kim family, it's important to note like little pieces in their early scenes. So one is there's like a picture on the wall celebrating a achievement of the father. So that tells you right. that he's not, you know, socially inept. He's not like in this like squalor because he did something wrong, but because it's a thing that just ends up happening because of the social forces. Like either you, there's an economic downturn and like you get let go, or at a certain age you're let go. But then you also hear like, oh, like, you know, they tried to open like a chicken shop and the chicken shop went down. So that's another reason that they're in poverty. And that speaks to the fact that because of the way that wealth is centered in like the these large corporations, people, once they retire or people who don't get into these roles, really have no choice to eke out a living but to make like a business. And the businesses will usually be a Castella shop. That's like a total thing that's referenced in the film, or a chicken shop or a pizza shop that they have at the very beginning, right?
Folding pizza boxes.
Right, right. So there's this whole economy where there's like way too much put into the service sector, like this hospitality industry, these businesses that are easy to run, to the point that I think there are more chicken shops in this tiny island nation of not island peninsula nation peninsula. Of South Korea yeah. than there are like McDonald's in the whole world. So if you can think about the way wow. that economy is skewed, it's ridiculous. And then finally, you have the family who the husband is living in the basement, right? And one of the things that like people don't know or don't tend to know about South Korea, and I've been talking for so long. Oh my God, I'm so sorry, guys.
But, keep going.
But it's interesting, or I hope it's interesting, is loan sharking in Korea, in South Korea, was a huge and continues to be a huge issue, because at some point, because of economic downturn, they took off regulations. For loans, or they like adjusted regulations so that loans could have like extremely high interest rates. And they've been bringing down the interest rates back down to like the 24-ish%, 22% that we're familiar with. But that's been happening within like the last like 10, 15 years. But yeah, so there's a system where you can get like loans from like, say, the government, you can get loans from the bank, and then you can choose like a third party lender, like a private lender. And those loans can be exorbitant. So the reason that this guy is in the basement is because he's running from loan sharks. And there's that mm-hmm. moment that the wife is the wife of the Kim family is like, "Oh, you took out loans?" And she says it with such disgust, you know. Mm-hmm. But the thing is, like, they're living in that squalor as well. So like, we can almost understand like what would drive someone to take out that kind of loan. But it's like, even at the sort of second level of like poverty, like the little bit higher level, they're very much looking down at the one that's right below them.
Right. So if you think of it from the perspective, you have someone who like lives above ground, someone who's semi basement level. So they are a little bit.
They still have a window.
But they still have that sliver of hope of being able to look out. And then you have the person living literally in the basement below them, right? Mm-hmm.
I think one interesting thing that we haven't really gone over yet is how the film clearly shows that the Kims are like extremely smart and savvy. They're fully capable of working hard and like seizing the opportunity, as you see with the pizza boxes. You know, they would do anything they could to get out of their poverty level. You know, Kiwoo is smart enough to get into the university, but the thing is, he just can't pay for the tuition. Whereas the Parks, they can hire tutors, and like an art therapist for their son. Mm-hmm. Like it's nothing. So it's not like they're unskilled or lazy. Like even the mom, you see that she won an award for some track and field event, right? Like she has a medal. It's the fact that they don't have the same opportunities. The financial problems don't give them the means to be successful. So he's doomed to just, that family's just doomed to keep folding the pizza boxes. And I think it's because the broken system never really gives them the chance, which is why they push so hard immediately when they get the chance to exploit the Park family for their personal gain.
I want to go ahead and take a quick break here and come back and talk about more unpacking the central themes and dive into class.
Have you always wanted to enjoy those delicious Taiwanese pineapple cakes but couldn't find a plant-based option to suit your dietary needs? I certainly have. It's literally the first thought that comes to my brain every morning. Well, I'm glad I found Annie's Tea Cakes. Annie's Tea Cakes is an Oakland-based food company on a mission to provide plant-based Chinese food options to the world. These vegan Taiwanese pineapple cakes can be available by placing an order through annie'steacakes.com. A portion of all profits go towards organizations supporting local sustainable agriculture. Again, go to annie'steacakes.com. That's Annie, spelled A-N-N-I-E, right now to get your vegan pineapple cakes.
Experiences by K is the Bay Area luxury picnic business that can be set up just about anywhere, from the beach, park, your backyard, and more. Simply go to the website, book your picnic, show up, and enjoy a good time with your friends, worry-free. Great for birthdays, anniversaries, proposals, you name it. Go to experiencesbyk.com right now for your upcoming occasion, and check out Experiences by K on Instagram. That's Experiences by K. And we're back. Thank you so much for staying with us. Continuing to unpack central themes, we wanted to go ahead and just talk about class and how it's represented in the film. Baldwin, why don't you go ahead and kind of take it away?
We see the very distinct difference in their homes, and that's obvious. But you notice how the movie constantly uses their physical location to show their economic status? Like, we went over this a little bit, but the Kims have to like constantly just trek upwards to the Park's home and then back down all the stairs and the alleyways to get back to their house. And then we even talked about the three levels of the Park's home, how there's the upper level where if you're accepted into the family, like you get to go into the kids' rooms, and then the bottom level where pretty much there's like, that's the bunker and the basement, where there's just like no hope, no light there. But there's even instances where the camera pans directly from the Parks down to, the Kims, like when they're sleeping on a couch, they're just like chilling on a couch there, and it just like slowly pans to see the Kims under the table, just like scrunched up, totally hiding and claustrophobic. And then there's like the use of light whenever they're in a position of hope or possible prosperity, they're in the light versus being in the dark when they're representing the lower class. And I think I read a quote from Junho. He said about the Kim's household, he said, like, you're still half underground. So there's this hope and there's a sense that you have access to light and you haven't completely fallen down to the basement yet. It's this weird mixture of hope and fear that you can fall even lower. Like, I don't know if you guys noticed it, but it's always contrasting the windows of the two households and the view that they get. I saw somewhere that it said it was intentionally shot to seem like they were actually facing each other. I think the Kim's household, the window is always shot from the right side versus in the Park household, it's always shot from the left side. Mm. These are very specific things you totally won't notice on your first go. And, you know, it also does a really good job in its blocking and composition in terms of framing the characters in a way that shows the class divide. So if you watch the movie again, you notice that there's constantly visual lines that separate the two families. Whenever the Parks are in the kitchen, someone from the Kim's family is always like around a corner spying on them, or they're positioned below them. And then the Parks are just like living with so much space that they seem almost distant from each other. Like the family is like rarely seen all together in the same frame. Whereas the Kim's household, is just claustrophobic. They're always together, like in the same space. So like the spatial relationships between these characters are really well established throughout the movie to enhance that difference between the two families.
Class is even represented in clothing and the fashion, right? That are, mm-hmm. that they're wearing. I mean, like Min, who is, Kevin's friend, Kiyu's friend, is basically, he's wearing, like, you can tell, like, even though it's very simple and things like that, you can tell, like, the fabric is a little bit more high quality, like the way that his hair is coiffed, right? And you see Kevin's hair is like this really nerdy, short,
bowl cut.
Yeah, exactly. And so I really liked the way that Junho really just kind of like hits it home, like the claustrophobic aspect of not having wealth to like this grandiose, big, huge opening. You know, they talk about sitting there in front of the window and just enjoying the sunlight as it hits through, right? Like,
exactly.
And you can really feel that. I actually, it was interesting because like the ending of the film has this swelling feel at the very end when Hugh's character like is standing there and, you know, he's like, I will buy that house and all you need to do is walk up from the basement, right? Mm-hmm. And like that, you know, you feel hopeful for them or for that aspect of it. And it was really interesting because even though you're probably supposed to hate the Kims, you kind of feel a little bit sad as well, right? There is that aspect of it. But it was just like leading all the way up into it, it was just like pure chaos, right?
I also want to say that I don't think you're supposed to hate the Kims. I think the Kims are supposed to show you how easy it is to fall into this darkness that the Kims are in.
Right.
Because even the moment where, you know, the mother has like totally beat up the wife that's underneath the basement.
Right.
She tells in the middle of the chaos, they're serving the Park family's like sudden party. And she tells Jessica like, oh, go take food down for them and make sure they're okay.
Right.
You know? And like, she isn't even thinking of it as like a, you know, I attempted murder, right? She's like, we were having like an internal poor people tiff. Let's just make sure that they're fed.
I know.
But obviously for them, it's like much darker because she has died. And so the husband is like, you know.
He's in a totally different headspace. Yeah.
He is. And yeah.
Thank goodness Jessica didn't go down there. She would have been killed without anyone seeing. Right?
But then like, whatever. Like she she gets killed with everybody
she
watching.
Does. I know, right? Yeah.
But I mean, I think that's also key in the film, right? Like that Jessica's character has to die because she's an interesting character. So talking about class really quickly, what you have in the differences is a lot of like material difference, right?
Right.
No one family is more, I would say like the Park family, like they don't have those close relationships. The husband's always like, love my wife. What a joke, you know? And so they have their issues. And then like, you see with the Kim family that the husband and wife pair actually really love each other. The kids are a little bit more disillusioned because they've grown up seeing other people have things and they don't have things. And then the pair at the bottom, at the basement, like are like ride or dies, right? They're like, whatever, it's the end. We'll just make sure to, you know, look out for each other in any way possible. And so I think like you get this juxtaposition of like, okay, you can do all of this for wealth, but what are you losing in the process, right? Like, what are we losing in the process of valuing just like this like external vision of like acceptability or success or achievement? And I think that's why, like, the Kim family is presented to us as polarizing, because it's meant to make you, like, think about all those things.
So, you know, living in the Bay Area, which we all do, we can be able to really see that here, right?
Yeah, definitely.
And I think that's one of the things that I really want to bring it back to, is that walking down Market Street in the city, you could be passing by billionaires at the same time as seeing, like, you know, tweaked out homeless people digging shit in the alley, right? You know, there was one time when, I think I already said this in the previous episode, but that basically I was just walking down the street of Market and, like, a receipt hit my ankle and I picked it up and it was like, how many zeros did this person have in their account? And they only withdrew like a 20 so they can go to the bar or something. And I was like pissed. I was like, at that point, I was only making like 37,000 in the city, you know, like that. I was, I was poverty line and, or worse.
No, you were below poverty.
I was, exactly. I lived in the fucking in-law unit. And for people who are listeners who don't know what that is, you have a house and in the garage, in the back is a small little area that they cut out from the garage to have, like, you know, a room for you to sleep in. I basically represented this expendable kind of, you know, just career in comparison to some of these people who work in the financial district.
Right.
That's one thing that was really interesting is, like, even though the movie wasn't necessarily made for an American audience, it was really trying to tell the story about, like, the wealth and class disparities in South Korea. I mean, like, we here in the Bay Area live in a bubble. Right. And I think that's why it was something that was still relatable to me. It was like, oh my God, like, I kind of feel like I'm living the life of being in a sub basement.
Yeah.
Of course.
Not even just basement, like sub basement.
Sub basement. Did you have a window at least?
Yeah, we did have a window. Yeah. But you know,
it's interesting you say that because I think this applies very specifically to areas with a high wealth disparity. Mm-hmm. Because I think about, like, your story, and then I think about, like, a friend who I have who lives in Vermont. He went bankrupt over his student loans and is buying a house 2 years later. Like, for them, it's easier to move through these things because, like, they're not dealing with, like, the pressure of the cost of living that we have to deal with. And Seoul is, like, the same thing. And there are other parts of South Korea as well where, like, there's a very pointed lack of opportunity. And then, like, it's like if you mess up, like, you mess way up.
Right,
you're
exactly.
going straight to the basement, you know, or sub-basement. Like, it's,
Well, I thought it was interesting how you guys talked about how, you know, all the levels of the classes are living in the same area. And I actually think it was a point that Juno was trying to make and sort of explore. You know, the movie is really pointing out how the unequal class system is creating these toxic relationships because you really can't have the wealthy living such luxurious lives while the poor live like insects and then have them occupy the same space. Like, you see, this is what happens in the movie. Mm-hmm. And it creates this sort of relationships where the wealthy are constantly looking down on the poor and they see them as dispensable, you know, and the ones at the bottom will always see it as an us versus them mentality. So, like, for both of them, they just want the best for the families. But in the society that they live in, and how competitive it is for the lower classes, it always pits them against each other and brings out the worst in them, which is what we see with the housekeeper and the Kim family. In that same vein, another thing I found interesting was how there isn't really any class solidarity. That's why I think, like, they never get out of this situation. Like, we talk about Snowpiercer and how that class, they rose up together and they were in solidarity and they were able to, like, make a difference, make a change. But in Parasite, you know, it's a dog-eat-dog world, especially among the poor, and that's why you see those families pit against each other. Even though there's a perfect solution right there to just join forces and have them both benefit.
We can all live off of the parks. Like,
from the situation together. And then there's that moment where the housekeeper is begging Chung-suk, the mother, to help for help and even appeals to the fact that they're in the same class and that they should have each other's back. But there's, like, no sympathy at all from the mother, from Chung-suk. And then when the housekeeper gets the upper hand, she flips the tables and she's like, fuck you, you filthy bitch. That was hilarious.
Oh, my God.
This is the world where the poor don't help each other. And then it goes back to that quote. You know, we talked about how they're nice because they're rich. And in this situation, they're not rich, so they're not nice.
And it's good that you brought that one up real quick, because I had wanted to say that, like, one of the key and I think only things that makes the Kims sort of, like, not my favorite is, like, you can do whatever to the parks. Like, I really don't care. Like, even as it gets violent, like, I'm not concerned, because I can sort of understand the amount of violence, the wealth that the parks accumulate sort of, like, brings on to everybody else, right? But when it comes down to, like, the class, like, sort of, like, conflict that's happening within the lower class, it's strange to me to watch the Kims now become basically a version of the parks. Like, they have the social mobility, so suddenly all they care about is their social class. Like, the human things that they felt for themselves when they were justifying, you know, their resentment is suddenly, like, it, like, not understandable anymore to them. They're like, oh, I forgot what that was about. I just get money, you know?
Right, exactly. I wanted to go ahead and pivot away from talking about our central themes and talk a little bit more about, like, just, like, the macro aspect of the film and its, you know, just impact. You know, like, I started off introducing the film as something that won in the Academy Awards, right? It won 4 of the, like, the most coveted awards: Best Picture, Best Director, Best Original Screenplay, and also Best International Film, a feature film, and that's, like, in descending order. Like, it was actually the first non-English language film to win Best Picture.
So we've talked about, you know, Snowpiercer, we've talked about Okja, we've talked about The Host, and all of these movies are, like, insanely political films. They're films that, like, have an opinion on, like, every sort of, like, question you could ask. Like, well, how do you feel about wealth? This is how it feels about wealth. How do you feel about colonial occupation, like, by America? In The Host, like, that is how it feels,
yes,
right?
Absolutely.
And even in Parasite, you see at the end that, like, the house goes on sale and it's given to a German family who doesn't know, like, the history, because no Korean in their right mind is going to buy that house after the murder.
Cursed.
It's cursed, right? So there is this aspect always in Bong Joon-ho's work, where he is making fun of, like, the sort of ignorance that the West has towards what goes on, in South Korea and in his films even. And so I wanted to talk about, like, yes, he won the Oscars and it was, like, a whole national celebration, but he's a famous director, but I don't know that he was particularly, like, so unanimously celebrated before the Oscars. And so there's this really funny interview with Vulture in which they're like, oh yeah, you know, like, what do you think of the fact that no other Korean film has ever even been nominated for an Oscar, despite the country's outsized influence on cinema in the past 2 decades? Which, by the way, like, Korean cinema is, like, off the charts. And he goes, it's a little strange, but it's not a big deal. He says, shrugging. And, like, you can imagine him sitting there, like, shrugging with like, nonchalant, like, you know, he goes, the Oscars are not an international film festival. They're very local. And that was, like, so good.
Mic drop.
So sassy. He goes, they're not even an international film festival. So, like, seeing...
Right. It's not Cannes.
Yeah.
Film festival.
And seeing that, like, contrast later with Minari, it's like he just called it. He was like, oh, foreign language film? Cool. Whatever. Yeah.
It's hilarious that you bring that up, because, like, you know, Joon-ho's view of the West, if you will. I mean, like, he even puts it into the film, right? Where the Parks, the mom and the dad, they're like, oh, is that tent going to hold up in the storm? And the father goes, yeah, of course. It's made in the U.S. And it's like, oh my God, I cackled. Oh my God.
That was perfect. Great.
But, you know, it is interesting how, in general, like, you have, like, this white adjacent or, like, American adjacent kind of, like, success, kind of baked into it, right? Like, I think we talked a little bit about how, you know, the siblings, they take on American names, right? Kevin and Jessica, and, like, how that made them feel more, seem, like, legit and successful because they went abroad and had, like, Americanized names.
And real quick, so the Americanized names are supposed to give them this credibility, right? Mm-hmm. And so on the meta level, the Americanized success of the film gives it credibility, which is why he's like, he's kind of like, okay, like side-eyeing that. But right. I have this like really funny little section. I'm going to read it real fast, right? So with his earlier films coming onto the American market, they were coming through like Scissorhand Weinstein. And Weinstein watches the film and he goes, wow, you're a genius. Let's cut out the dialogue. And Bong Joon-ho is like, what? And so there's like this scene where like he's cutting a fish and Harvey wants to take it out. And Bong Joon-ho is like, okay, like he's not cool with this, right? And so he goes, no, this shot means something to me. And Harvey Weinstein is like, oh, like what does it mean? And he goes, it's something personal. My father was a fisherman. I'm dedicating this shot to my father.
Oh my gosh. <laughs> Wait.
So Harvey goes, oh yeah, no, for sure. Like if it's a family thing, like that's the most important thing. You have to keep the shot. And the next thing Bong Joon-ho says, just like I was cackling, he goes, I said, thank you. It was a fucking lie. My father was not a fisherman.
Oh, love it. Oh, man.
He was like, yeah, I made that shit up. So, like, you can see the scamming just coming into the meta as well.
Yeah.
But in this case, totally well justified, I feel like.
So maybe you could talk a little bit about, you know, how Bong Joon-ho always kind of being a prankster, always kind of like on the, like the, what is it, like a fringe kind of director, maybe?
Yeah. So like, I think the fringe director aspect of his work is that he is always unafraid to make films that go opposed to what the government is like, you know, what their main stance is. And he'll do it very obviously. And there's not a lot of like English language discourse about the fact that this critique or like how it's received when it's understood like goes. So like for us, like it's a very left-leaning thing to like you know, not approve of like the government in certain types of ways. And like overall, it's a very acceptable thing to just like talk all sorts of crap on the government, no matter where on the whole political spectrum you fall. But for South Korea, the alignment with America is like a very important alignment. And so there is, like, it's a very important alliance. And there's this almost, I want to say, generation of directors, including like Park Chan-wook, who will make films that like sort of like outwardly call out the precariousness of the situation where they're dependent on America. Mm. And so The Host is a good example of this, because, you know, you have those different like agencies and each of the agencies like back-to-back fail the main character who has lost his daughter to like this like Godzilla-like figure that was created by Americans, right? So it's like a conversation with the Godzilla film where like the nuclear disaster causes that monster. Here, right, it's like exactly. The American presence causes this monster. And so his films, when they're taken as like a blockbuster film, like you're watching it, like, you know, everyone said, watch it. This is such a good movie. You may be watching it without like this idea that like the philosophical arguments that he's making or the things he's trying to bring in front of you are actually quite radical, and especially quite radical within his context. So that's a good thing to like, you know, go hunt more for on Google and figure out like, you know, what exactly each film is about.
I absolutely hope that, you know, here at Real Asian Podcast, we can actually do more Bong Joon-ho films.
Yeah.
Because I definitely want to be able to talk about like The Host, about Okja. Mm-hmm. Snowpiercer wasn't nearly as like Asian centric, but you know, like it was still really good. And you know, if you love Song Kang-ho,
he's in all the movies. He's in every single movie.
The only one he isn't in is Okja.
And he's funny that he's also in the Chan-wook movies, or so the Park Chan-wook movies. Like he appears in literally like every film of this quality. Like
There's something about his character, maybe like one of my favorite scenes is actually him when they're like feeding him lines to kind of like act before he actually tells the mom, the mother in part, where he's all like overacting and everything. Mm-hmm. And the son's like, tone it down. You're like here.
Yeah, but he's like the veteran actor that everybody is just like so like honored to like act with, right?
Right, literally. Okay, so we're gonna go ahead and end the podcast on a Love It or Leave It segment. You know, Baldwin, I know you said that you really love this film. There's very few things that you want to leave it, but I'm going to go ahead and put you in the hot seat. Love it and leave it, Baldwin.
I love it, very obviously, as you could tell from the whole episode. There's so many things about it. One thing I really liked about the movie is that there's really just no villain, like we talked about it. The Parks aren't evil. The Kims, we kind of don't like them for what they do, but they're not evil, right? And with the Parks, their flaw is that they're detached from reality because of their wealth. And the Kims, who are supposed to be the antagonists in the movie, they're not really great people. So the archetypal roles aren't so cut and dry in the movie. And I feel like the evil in the system that, or the evil is the system that creates these two families, on the opposite sides of the economic spectrum. So they're really symptoms of the larger societal problem that creates these parasitic relationships, because after the Park family leaves, there's another family that comes in. And then another thing with Parasite is that, so it shows the effects of the unequal class systems, but it's not really trying to push forward a solution, right? Mm-hmm. It's just bringing them to light so we can see that maybe like we can find an inspiration as an audience to try to change the system. You know, something interesting I read, you know, there's the part in the movie where Guangsa is trying to communicate with Mr. Park by using the lights and like the Morse code. So I actually read that no adult in the movie is understanding the Morse code. And that actually means that the lower class's message never reaches the upper class. So the upper class never seems to understand it. But the interesting thing is that the boy actually gets it, and it sort of reflects the sentiment by Bong Joon-ho that he has some faith in the newer generations. So it's like those little small things that are just like littered throughout the movie that make it so interesting for me.
I mean, real quick, I did want to say, I think there are some like 17th century French Revolution minded people that would find the Kim family to be the protagonists of the films and not the antagonists.
Yeah, I can see that.
Yeah. And I'm undecided myself. I just like want to talk about like, you know, specific parts of like what I loved, what I didn't love. Overall, the film is great. Like the critique and the way that it puts everything in front of you is great. The fact that it doesn't, you know, push its own solution or ask you immediately for a solution is great. Like, it understands that it's the beginning of a conversation, and that for a lot of people, it's going to be their first sort of engagement with this kind of topic or this kind of way of seeing things. So overall, like, I really enjoyed all of the aspects of the film, from the cinematography, the set design, which I know Baldwin talked more about, the dialogue, the writing, and obviously the actors did a brilliant job. I think the leave it for me is the peach fuzz, where they're like, she's allergic to peaches, so we're going to get peach fuzz and put it everywhere and like attempt to kill her, real casual, like anaphylaxis is just not a thing. I was like, dang, like y'all are already like peak, like just like ready to violence, and I'm just not sure that you need to choose it quite yet. Yes,
my love it. You know, both of you make amazing points, obviously, about like some of the things that were really amazing about the film. My love it is just like, I love Bong Joon-ho. He's just an amazing director and you know, screenplay writer, and it's just like everything about this film really was like lyrically beautiful. My love it definitely centers around the fact that there's this delicate balance of being able to display like class disparity and wealth disparity in a way that is still approachable even for non-Korean people as well. Since you already said my number one leave it, I'm gonna have to say my other leave it was Kevin taking advantage of that poor girl.
Oh God, yeah.
It opens up with, you know, in the film, Min asking him like, "Hey, can you like just watch over her? Because like all these other college people are just going to take advantage of her." Mm-hmm. And he immediately just like develops this relationship with her, and I was just like, "Come on, guy."
Inappropriate.
Yeah, but you know, so it was really interesting. I think of everyone else that had like a three-dimensional character, it was really interesting that the daughter Dahi
is her name.
Dahi, like, yeah, it was like, yeah, it was that she basically had a very flat kind of one-dimensional kind of character in that regard.
I mean, I don't know if like flat, I think there was a lot of like cultural stuff baked into that, that like is like very difficult from us for the outside to like pull apart. But like tutor relationships are totally a thing, and it's totally a creepy thing.
Wow. Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, exactly.
And like it's specifically like right. rich, like young women who like sort of fall prey to this kind of, yeah, there's just a lot there. So your leave, it's a big one.
Yeah, I know, right? Yeah. At the very end of this. Sorry. Yeah. I guess that'll have to be another discussion then.
Yeah.
But that's going to end it for today. Thank you so much for joining us as we dissect Parasite. Mm-hmm. Really enjoyed our time here. Thank you so much, Baldwin. And thank you, Progra.
Yeah.
Thanks, guys. Bye.
See you.
Hey, rap heads. If you really want to support us, follow and subscribe to our podcast now. And don't forget to review our show on Apple Podcast. We'd love to hear from you.